Well, hello, and welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold on this Friday. It's been a while. I'm Rick Moore, along with Josh Arnold, our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky, and here we are approaching... No, we're in the holiday season, I guess. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
You got a mess here, man. Yeah. You are an absolute mess. Jeez. You got to put... Okay, that's on first. There you go. Good. And now that. There you go. Okay, there we are.
So I've got Julie LaFontaine from Cape Ann Food Pantry, and I have Joanne Castano from the Advocate for the Arts locally, and Hallie Baker, who is a chocolatier from Turtle Alley Chocolates, is our third guest. We've tried to get her on before. We finally...
I've met her over on Roger Street, and it's a fabulous place, and she's absolutely awesome. But I got to tell you, when I first opened the email and saw who your guests were, I thought my eyes just all of a sudden said Halle Berry, and I said... Well, that's appropriate for the season, but damn, how did you get a hold of Halle Berry?
Yeah.
So Halle Baker is just as good, if not better, so we look forward to that interview coming up. That's all coming up here as we return on this Friday after a few weeks off. This is Trending Now. We'll be back with our first guest.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service, and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodright Double Hung Insert Window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our first guest is Julie LaFontaine, the Executive Director of Cape Ann Food Pantry. Julie, welcome to the program.
Well, it's great to be here, Josh.
Lots of things happening during the holiday season. You folks are, I'm sure, straight out. Tell us some of the things that you're involved in, helping all the many folks that your organization serves.
Yeah, so I'm Julie LaFontaine, Executive Director of the Open Door, Cape Ann's Food Pantry and beyond. And the Open Door does have two food pantries, a food pantry here in Gloucester and one in Ipswich. And we serve 10 cities and towns in the northeast corner of Essex County. Last year we served 6,917 people. And we did that by providing 1,398,837 pounds of food, which is an awful lot of food.
Wow.
Here in Gloucester, we're serving 1 in 6 Gloucester residents with either the food pantry or a mobile market. So food pantries are a primary way that we're meeting the need in the community, alleviating the impact of hunger. But we also have our community meals program, our mobile markets, and we just finished up, Josh, with a record Thanksgiving basket distribution, 1,228 turkeys and all of the fixings, which was nearly 7,500 meals that went out for Thanksgiving Day.
Wow, that's great.
So the Open Door works closely with the American Legion, who does a terrific job preparing and serving a meal on Thanksgiving Day and delivering meals to people who can't cook for themselves or may be shut in. But the Open Door really works hard to make sure that families and individuals have a turkey and all of the fixings to make at home with their own traditions and their own recipes. Because, you know, Josh, you know, you think about Thanksgiving and you think about coming around the table with your family and there's kind of all the really great memories that you have from that. And that's what the Open Door works hard to do.
Great, great. The what did you say? The mobile dinner or the
mobile market?
Mobile market.
Yeah.
Explain that to me a little bit.
So since 2005, the Open Door has been using a model that actually goes out to where people live and where they learn, bringing basically a small farmer's market to public housing neighborhoods, to low-income schools, to senior centers. There were several years that we actually served a hotel in Danvers on the southbound side of Route 1 where there were 101 homeless families housed. They're no longer there, but during the time that they were there, we brought a mobile market there. Most recently, we responded to a hunger survey done by North Shore Community College, and they found that more than 60% of their students were food insecure, meaning that they didn't have consistent, adequate access to nutrition, or they were at risk of being homeless. And so at the request of the North Shore Community College president and student affairs office, the Open Door teamed up with Beverly Bootstraps and the Greater Boston Food Bank to bring a monthly mobile market to the Danvers campus of North Shore Community College.
Oh, that's great.
And there are about 300 participating students, and we give away between 3,000 and 4,000 pounds of food each time that we go. And again, if when I say mobile market, think farmer's market. And there are tents and there are baskets of potatoes and carrots and onions and fresh produce, and people are able to go through the line and get some food to go home and help put food on the table.
And there's also, if I'm not mistaken, there are some initiatives that you are either directly or indirectly involved with where people are growing and harvesting stuff that then feeds into, not pun intended, but then draws into some of these mobile operations as well?
You are right, absolutely, Josh. So the food that goes through the Open Door programs comes 57% from the Greater Boston Food Bank, and we have a very robust food rescue program, which means our trucks are out on the road picking up from grocery stores and growers, and particularly farmers. We during the growing season, we'll get what's called B product. So it might be an apple or a potato that's not the right size to go to market but still has plenty of nutritional value, and that food comes to the food pantry and is given out, or it goes into our kitchen and is made into, one time we had literally tons of turnips, and so we brought the turnips in, we put them into the kitchen, and we made some turnip French fries in the oven, and we made some turnip potato salad and had the recipes and then little samples for people to try when they came to use the food pantry, and then they could take that recipe home with the turnips and the ingredients to make the same recipe at home. Right. And in that way, we use the food rescue food. We also wholesale purchase food, and then we have really great community collections. And in fact, I mentioned that we'd given out 1,228 turkeys with all of the fixings, but in addition to that, we had just over 38,000 pounds of food donated in the Thanksgiving food drive during the month of November.
That's great.
In addition to that, so it was a lot of food coming in. A really great community.
So, if Rotary or other service organizations wanted to get a piece of land or rent a piece of land or to have a huge vegetable garden, they could grow that stuff for your program?
Josh, that sounds like a wonderful project. Are you volunteering to run it?
I would be interested in helping.
So we do, we do work with existing growers, and certainly another well-known and well-loved organization in town, the Backyard Growers. We have actually, I don't know if you knew this, Josh, but we have 14 raised beds on our own property where we're raising produce that's going into the pantry and into the salad bar and our community meals program. And, so we're utilizing fresh and locally grown food right on our property as well.
Well, I took I've always had a vegetable garden at home, and I've always been frustrated living in Riverdale off Wheeler Street. And two or three years ago, I ripped out, went down 2.5 feet the length of the garden, the width of the garden, ripped everything out, brought that super mulch and screen loam from Marshall's Farm Stand in, and so we feed everybody in the neighborhood.
That's great. That's,
because I grew up in East Gloucester. My father was a landscape gardener, and he made his own soil, so it was foreign to me to go live other places and find garbage in terms of, really awful soil mixes to try to plant a garden in. But I know the Winthrop Estate leases property because they're under they're taxed as a farm because of their so many acres, 750-acre estate, I think it is, but there are, you could actually rent several acres to plant a garden if you could get half a dozen clubs or groups to commit to want to grow stuff there. So that's food for thought going forward for you.
Right, absolutely, and food for thought it is. I will let you know, too, that one thing that the Open Door has been really diligent about is, as we're rescuing food, of course, we're getting food that may have a shorter shelf life, but still has good nutritional value, and whatever we're not using, we're not putting into the landfill, we're actually composting, and we use a local compost company to make sure that we're getting that out, and it is going back, it's getting turned back into the soil.
Okay, now you have some affiliation with the Sunday Shelter with the Grace Center.
Yeah, so this is actually the second year that the Open Door has literally opened its doors to the Grace Center to provide a Sunday shelter during the months that are traditionally colder. So starting in the beginning of December through the end of March, from 10:30 in the morning until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the Open Door is open for people from the homeless shelter or from the Grace, people who would be using the Grace Center during the week to come and, have a hot cup of coffee and some soup and a place to hang out of the cold. During the week, the Grace Center is open Monday through Friday, and on Saturday there are some public buildings that are open, but on Sunday there really wasn't anything open. And so, as a collaboration amongst partners, the Open Door brought the facility to the table. We provide the food, we provide some security, and then the Grace Center provides the staff, and together we get a big job done.
And that's the organization that Father Garibaldi is involved in?
It is a multi faith group, working on it, but it is called the Grace Center, and it is a program that provides day shelter and wraparound services for some of our more vulnerable citizens.
Great. And on your mark, workforce development program, tell me about that.
Yeah, so I'm really excited. This last year, the Open Door launched a program called On Your Mark. It is a youth workforce development program for youth ages 16 to 21. It has a culinary track and it has a retail track, and it is nested within our existing program. So the kids will come in. They have 2 days of experiential learning. So if you're on the retail track, you're working at Second Glance for 2 days. If you're on the culinary track, you're in the kitchen for 2 days. And then there's a third day of classroom experience where you're learning some life skills. And then that is, you're learning time management and how to show up to work on time and how to write a resume and stress management and teamwork and positive attitude and all of those things. And this program has finished its first cohort. It's well into its second cohort of students who've come in. And we were really excited just this week, actually, to partner with another program that's very similar in Salem called Root. And our students together prepared a meal and served it to some senior population in Salem along with some other guests. So it was about 50 people. It gave them some really great hands-on experience in a different environment, and it was very successful. I think people really liked it.
And the students that are involved, these are high school and college students?
So they're ages 16 to 21.
Okay,
and, you know, they're largely kids. Some of our students have been still in high school, but we're looking for that person who might not quite know what their next step really is. And, we're opening doors, giving someone an edge when they enter the workforce. So in the culinary track, you're actually getting a ServSafe certification, which is just kind of an entry qualification for working with food in the food service industry. And then in the retail environment, you're getting opportunity to have some register experience and merchandising experience and workforce experience before you head out and find another job. So it's a launching pad. It's not a destination, but a launching pad.
Right.
And we're really excited with the kids who have come along and been involved.
You mentioned Second Glance, which is a store where people can buy things. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So Second Glance is a program of the Open Door. It is located over on Pond Road, and it is 10,000 square feet of shopping pleasure and treasure. It does provide low-cost items to the community. It also raises revenue to support our hunger relief programs. It's recycling on steroids. Everything in the store is something someone didn't want anymore, and it's getting a second chance on our shelves. We also have the training opportunity over there. We have the On Your Mark kids, as well as kids who will come from the North Shore Education Consortium or the Gloucester High School Transitions Program to work with a job coach and get some workforce and job workplace exposure, and then we also give away a lot of furniture and clothing and household items through a referral program.
How much?
All in all, it is a program that is vital to the Open Door. It helps us achieve our mission to alleviate the impact of hunger in the community, and also just provides a tremendous service to the community.
I was sitting next to Carol Sheriff in Rotary this past Tuesday, and she was remarking about the 10th anniversary of the fire that claimed the synagogue and the Lorraine Apartments and damaged the YMCA and some other buildings on Middle Street. And I said, wow, has it been 10 years? And I spearheaded the Rotary effort to do the furniture drive for the people who were victims of the Lorraine Apartment fire. But I was very... warmly appreciative of the number of people who donated furniture for those tenants, and what I had hoped would come out of that, I was hoping we could get a warehouse somewhere where people who had furniture that they wanted to maintain or keep could go and then people, volunteers could come in and fix it up and could go to a program like yours.
Right. Yeah, well, I remember that well, Josh, because I drove a truck on a couple Saturdays to go around and pick that stuff up, and it was a really great outpouring from the community and the Rotarians and the other volunteers who helped us gather that up. And I think that your idea was a terrific one, and I think Second Glance actually has really become that warehouse. We have 1,800 square feet dedicated to furniture processing and fixing and storing, and as I mentioned, when someone needs something at no cost, it is available to them. So I think in a lot of ways we've been able to maybe be an extension of that vision. So
so if people listening have a couch or a dining room set or something that they would like to part with, how would they go about doing that?
So the really great thing, Josh, is Second Glance offers furniture pickup. We don't pick up other stuff, but we do pick up furniture. And the store can be called directly at 978-283-4298, and you can schedule a furniture pickup. We do pick up Monday through Friday, with the exception of major holidays or snowstorms and other acts of God.
Yep, yep.
But you can get on that list and get a pickup. It is important to note that our team really is not qualified to go up to a second or third floor to get anything. It's got to be down on a first floor and accessible. But we can do that, and there is no charge to you for us to come pick it up. And that is just another way that you can recycle your things out and know that they're helping someone else.
Well, you mentioned that when we did the furniture drive, we had the late John Gigoloni, the city councilor, had a sleep sofa couch that he donated, and it took six of us to get it out of the third floor where it was.
That is one thing, and I'm glad you brought that up, but, there are a few things we can't take, and sleeper sofas is one of them, and now you know why.
Yeah, so we get it down, and Johnny says, well, if any of those people, I have an apartment here that they could rent, and so we get back to the trailers at the DPW, when we had people, it would go in, tenants from the Lorraine Apartments, and put their sticker on it, and claim it, So one woman comes by and puts her sticker on it, and she decides she might be interested in John Gigoloni's apartment. And I'm looking at her and says, "You mean we got to bring that gun back?" It was one of those.
One of those moments.
Yeah.
Well, it was a good effort all the way around, Josh.
It was
a sad day for our community, with the fire. And the way people came around it really was heartwarming.
Well, we pulled enough stuff together. Not only did we cover all of the tenants in that fire, but we sent maybe a half a dozen truckloads to Beverly and Lawrence, who had fires after us. That's how good the outpouring of support was. So,
right. Well, Josh, I think that we agree. We live in a really tremendous community, and that's just one example of the way people turn out to help their own.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I can't tell you how much I appreciate what you do and what your organization does, and it really feels a huge void in the community, thank you again for all that you do for the community in this capacity and many other volunteer things that you do, including Rotary.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Josh, and the same back to you.
All right. Take care. Have a good holiday. We'll talk
you
to you
too.
Soon. All right.
Bye-bye.
Ever wish that help with your business was as nearby as your next-door neighbor? At Cape Ann Savings Bank, we're the folks who have helped our neighbors build prosperous communities since 1846. And we invite you to give us a call, discuss your vision, and learn how we can help you grow your business. We're here for you. You have questions. We have answers. Just give us a call, 888-283-CASB, or visit capeannsavingsbank.com. Member FDIC, DIF, Equal Housing Lender.
Gloucester's Walter Wilkins Insurance Agency is teaming up with Columbia Insurance to deliver a full line of products, personal home and auto policies, as well as a full line of commercial coverage for business owners, including commercial property and commercial vehicle coverage. Wilkins partners with respected companies such as Plymouth Rock, Quincy Mutual, Commerce, and Safeco. For City of Gloucester employees, there are discounts on auto and home policies. Wilkins Insurance is located at 186 Main Street, Gloucester, now partnering with Columbia Insurance, serving the North Shore.
Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Joanne Castano, who's a advocate for the arts on Cape Ann and some other things as well. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Josh. Thanks an awful lot for having me on.
We should start out with a little bio. I know you for years, but for our listening audience, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we could get in some questions.
Okay, I'm a sculptor, an artist that has engaged in a lot of cultural development. I started back in the 77 receiving the first grants and probably the largest in Massachusetts through the CETA program, which Gloucester also appreciated having programs here as well. So I received over $500,000 to create cultural economic development programs by creating programs with the communities of Newburyport, Salem, and also it was in Brockton, Massachusetts. So we created residencies for artists, year-long residencies, and did job training for artists during that time and worked with the impact of these communities once they had gone through urban development by enlivening these communities through the arts. And then I landed up coming to Gloucester eventually, where many of the artists that we employed were from Gloucester, and my husband was a planner in Salem who lived in Gloucester, so that's how I met him, and I came to Gloucester and started working on my own work, and eventually got involved with the Plan 2000 and trying to develop cultural economic development here. I noticed that in Gloucester, we weren't receiving any national or state funds for the arts, so I embarked on a program and got a lot of consultants from Peter Anastas, who had been quite involved over the years of coordinating and being involved in the arts. So we eventually worked with Harriet Webster, who had the pilot program of going out and looking at cultural development in ways of creating a maritime academy, a maritime museum, and an art center. The Maritime, of course, got kicked off, and then a few of us in the program continued with the arts and established the Committee for the Arts. And the Committee for the Arts went on to help establish and work on the Plan 2000, where we put in that plan cultural development within the master plan, and also started SEARTS, the Society for the Encouragement of the Arts, which is still going as a coalition of artists working on cultural economic development. And so those are basically the major programs here.
Okay. And what's happening in the art and cultural world of Gloucester, Cape Ann, in the last year or last several months that you can tell us about?
No, I don't know everything because there is so much.
Okay.
Excuse me. The Trident Gallery is always extremely active, and they're working with Ocean Alliance, incorporating and collaborating with art, science, and technology, which is a wonderful initiative going forward, and doing exhibitions back and forth there. The Writers' Center is continually always doing wonderful programming and storytelling, and they've opened up the Charles Olson Library there as well, which is bringing all of his works back.
Did you ever meet or know Charles Olson?
No, I didn't.
I met him when 'cause his son Charlie lived in the neighborhood. And what a huge guy. I mean, he was just a great, big, imposing figure. And in the fifth or sixth grade, I did a report on him for one of my classes at Eastern Avenue School, and went to the house on which is now condominiums on Mount Pleasant Avenue. And,
up in the fort?
A lot of his stuff was at the Radoslovich House, which is next to what used to be East Gloucester Fire Station. It's those condos. And so I went there to read books and stuff that he had read. Didn't understand any of it. I mean, it was well beyond my sixth grade level. but I was able to do a good report on him just the same.
Yeah. I think that a lot of... that's what's wonderful about the programs that are going on here is that it engages a lot of youth.
Yeah.
And whether what they understand now and how people engage with the youth as artists, it's incredible to watch even the kids of the artists that I've known over the, you know, last 25, 30 years here, and then they're having kids, and their kids are growing up, and they've been involved in the theaters or in the music or with, you know, Benjamin or
KPN
Museum or Gloucester Stage Company and Folk Life Theater. You have all segments of the community have been engaged in something that's happening, and it's expanding out to, you know, Theater in the Pines, and you've got the Annisquam Theater. So it's families growing up enriched by arts everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's what's so rich about Gloucester is that, you know, it's a can-do, doing kind of community that's always been engaged with each other in neighborhoods, and it's a rich community, a rich place.
Well, if you go back to the late 1800s to early 1900s, and you look at pictures of that era, there were massive hotels in Gloucester in Cape Ann. Many of those had their own theater in the hotels. And I know, having read different books, Franklin Delano Roosevelt wanted his daughter to be married in one of those in Magnolia. And the Secret Service vetoed it because at the time 128 didn't exist. So they had to, and there were too many curves on 129. They said, we can't protect you. But folks, Kitty Carlisle, that people remember from television to tell the truth and other things, she used to perform at the theater at the Moreland Hotel down, which is now, again, condominiums on the back shore.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's amazing. They a lot of places throughout Europe and the United States have tried to build art hotels.
Yeah.
So that all of the rooms have art in them, but they have a theme or something more involved with the arts. And it's, you know, I see that probably coming back a bit, that you have these centers within these kinds of spaces, living spaces and hotels. But it's...
The Mass Cultural Council was in town recently.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that, what they were doing here and what that's all about?
Well, Mass Cultural Council has been invested in Gloucester for... since 93. Well, of course, they always have been with the local cultural council funding. But they have invested quite a bit through the cultural facilities funds, cultural economic development, the Adams funds that have come into Gloucester, and the cultural district. So they've got quite an investment in Gloucester, and they keep coming back and engaging with us more and more because of their not only financial investment. They have their people who have been coming here and working with the cultural institutions and individual artists. And they also helped work on Plan 2000 with us. And so they just have a great investment here. They have worked on cultural economic development for many, many years. They were the ones with the New England Foundation for the Arts who pretty much kicked that off, and they've been a great model throughout the country. And now they're looking at the impact of culture and what their, I guess you could look at the benchmarks that has happened over the years and how they're connecting all of these communities all across Massachusetts through empowering the arts, and so that you have a stand in the community. And now we kind of understand our legislators and our local communities understand, and as well as the business community, the economic impact that the arts do have on communities and delivering revenues and opportunities for so many here. So they're refocusing and have a new mission, and they're focusing on the impact that culture. So they're focusing more on economic, it is economic development, but it's the power of culture in communities and how it enlivens and communities and engages. They're also looking at the cultural facilities still that many organizations here in Gloucester have benefited from, as well as empowering more in youth development through the arts and culture. And not only do we have the arts and culture, economic development, but if you look at the seaport and the maritime kinds of cultural, a lot of people came here to experience a place. And that experience also is with the arts and cultural programs, the museum, history, and now they're focusing also in a lot of the sciences as well, and the environment, and how artists can be at the table and work with developers in doing more planning. We were a bit ahead in our day where we were working with the city and doing the master plan. So as we move forward, they'll be encouraging more artists being at the table and working more towards empowering pretty much everybody that can be standing up at the table and be heard.
Now you've mentioned
they're developing new programs around that and focusing on accessibility for everyone to get into institutions. So there's a lot of accessibility, handicapped accessibility.
Yeah, one of my future pushes to happen here in Gloucester would be the establishment of a Disabilities Rights Commission. Salem has one, Newburyport has one, Gloucester should have one. And it would impact, it would be a favorable thing for you know, whether it's funding. I spoke to Senator Tarr about it recently, mm-hmm. David DiArcangelo, who's Governor Baker appointed to head an agency here in the state, would come down and talk to the city council about why it's important and set it up. So that would be that's
fantastic.
That's my on my agenda for 2018. So, but I
engage the arts in that while you're doing it.
Yes, absolutely.
They have a whole program around that. So if you apply for most any federal and state grants, you have to make sure that every place is accessible, handicapped accessible.
Yeah, no, I having been had positions in school administration in the last century, I took a crash course in all that, and it's to this day I can't walk into a building that I don't, you know, have the mental checklist where the sprinklers are and all that stuff. Yeah, but anyway.
I think as we move forward also and go through artist live workspace, which is one of our priorities here in Gloucester and always has been. You'll notice that in many communities. Here we don't have the big factories and those kind of industrial buildings that are being turned into live workspace or artist studios that you see happening everywhere. But one of the things that you look at is making sure that there's sprinklers. I mean, there's people that feel that sprinklers aren't needed or something is grandfathered into some of the buildings. And I think we have to, the city and any arts group that is invested in trying to create live workspace really focuses on that the lives are protected in these units that may be being developed. Firewalls and accessibility and access to in and out and sprinklers and fire alarms.
It's you're right. I mean, we had that fire on the Schlichty building a few years back. It was the strength of the firewall that kept that out of Bank Gloucester. It's a different world, and you know, fire codes change generationally. Back when they built Gloucester High School, the code was if you were exiting a classroom, you had to be able to exit two ways. So you could exit.
Mm-hmm. You need double access.
Be able to go left or right. 20 years later, you had to have two separate exits from a ground level.
Yeah.
And then it became more. restrictive in some other ways. Always err on the side of caution for the people who are going to use the facility. So, what you're involved in the manship restoration? Tell us. I mean, I knew the manships would see them in church years ago at Sacred Heart. But for listening audience, who were the manships, and what is it you're doing with the manship property to preserve that?
Rebecca Reynolds, who is an art historian, and also she worked at, she doesn't work there now because she's so involved in this project, but at the Museum of Fine Arts, she was the curator of American sculpture. And she was contacted by the Manship Estate to curate the estate and the artwork of Paul Manship, and also John Manship. There's many paintings of his that are still in the family collection. And as Rebecca was called, they hired her to be the curator for the estate. So she's been working with the attorneys and the family that, you know, that's still involved over the last 10 years. And she knew the Manships. And she used to, as they got older, she would take them to exhibitions that they wanted to go to. They shared the interest in the arts, of course, and what they were doing. And she knew what they wanted to have the property to be an international artist residency. This is where artists come in, interdisciplinary artists would come in from all over the world, so it was international, and would be staying for anywhere from 3 weeks to 6 weeks and live at the property in community with each other and to work on their arts freely. So those kinds of programs are being researched and looked into to establish this, and we just purchased the property, so our main goal was to secure the property from being developed. So we had to come up with a plan and a study, and Mass Cultural Council once again came to the rescue and came in and gave us funding to do feasibility studies and business plans so that we could execute the next stages of being able to secure the property, which is a little over 5 acres in Lanesville. And it sits nestled between two of the quarries there. And it's the Manship House as well as the Oxen Barn, which was Manship's studio. And there's little buildings around the 5 acres, which used to be, like a painting studio or storage space. And the Paul Manship, a lot of people don't know who Paul Manship is. And the best way to describe that is the Prometheus sculpture, which is at the Rockefeller Center, of the golden boy at the ice skating rink that holds his arms out.
Yeah.
That's Paul Manship's work.
Okay.
And he's also the sphere that he worked on. He's got sculptures all over the world. And he's the father of Art Deco, pretty much, and he came here to work many years ago with Gravely, and a lot of artists come here. It's because of the environment, but because there's so many artists here, people come because of other artists and to work with them or study under them, and there's such a large community of people here. So the importance of the Manship property is out of that era of sculptors that lived and worked here and created their own studios. The Manship property is one of the last ones that we can preserve the legacy of that era, as well as continue working with the local community and artists and engage that kind of a center that will be nationally recognized and significant for, as well as internationally, of being able to preserve something like that.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. We could talk to you all day. There's so many things to talk about.
Yeah, there are so many things.
You and I will be talking off the show in the coming weeks, but maybe next year we can have you on and you can tell us some more about what's happening with the arts.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and look forward to seeing you in the new year.
Have a happy holiday.
Happy holiday to you, too, and happy new year.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. And if you're thinking about replacing the windows in your home, please see the Anderson Woodwright replacement windows. Why Anderson? With low E glass, low maintenance exteriors, and rich wood interiors, you can turn simple window replacement into significant home improvement. See the Anderson Woodwright replacement windows on display at Moynihan Lumber in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Hallie Baker, who is a chocolatier with Turtle Alley Candies here in Gloucester and elsewhere. Welcome to the program, Hallie.
Good morning.
Usually start out and ask people to give us a 3 or 4 minute bio, tell us about yourself, and then we can get into some questions about what it is to be a chocolatier.
Okay, well, I started the shop about 18 years ago. We've been doing it in Gloucester for that many years, and our Salem shop has been going on for about 15 years. I started off in art school, so, you know, when you're in art school, you generally want to work in food, which means that I kicked around a lot of kitchens before I settled on working in a little confectionery in Beverly that has since done quite well, and I learned a lot there.
Okay.
So I'm not really sure where else to go with that.
Okay, all right, that's fine. So tell us about Turtle Alley. You started it when, and what? How's business? What motivated you to become a chocolatier, and what is that industry like today?
Well, those are all really excellent questions. I started in 1999. I did it because I felt like I had something to give to people that was slightly different than what was out there at the time. I also was really motivated by some of my past experiences as an employee to be a better manager or boss than what I had experienced. And that was sort of a big deal, making sure that I created a work atmosphere that was a place that I would want to work, you know. Those were the two sort of really driving things. I have sort of an unusual palate. I was brought up by people who were amazing cooks, like in the 70s, right? So back when you couldn't always get cilantro in the grocery store. So as a result, my palate was different than a lot of people, and I just knew that there was a chance to sort of be in the candy business and be able to sort of like break out of the tried and true. Now, of course, we carry all the tried and true, although I don't make creams. I don't like them. But everything else, like we have all the standards, but I think even in 1999, we had chipotle bark, which was pretty unusual at that time, even though the Aztecs have been mixing chili and chocolate since the beginning of time. Okay. So but that's sort of why I started, and I'm really glad it worked out because I could never have a boss again.
Yeah. What is the candy industry like today, and how many shops like yours are out there where people actually make the candy? I mean, you'll have places where they offer fudge or what have you. But what you don't see a lot of candy shops today.
Not independent ones. The independent ones are pretty small. I will say that most of the time I'm just making candy on my own private island, which I love, so I don't pay a whole lot of attention, but it's impossible to not see that when you go to other places in the country, like, there aren't a lot of independent candy shops.
Yeah.
And that's especially true, sort of, my experiences traveling in different places on the West Coast. I think the East Coast seems to have a higher concentration of them, and I'm not sure why that is.
We're sweeter people here.
Yeah, well, you know, and we need our treats because the winters are brutal. So that's part of it, too.
Comfort food.
Comfort food, exactly.
So,
I think one thing about the industry that's really changed, and it's been, like, a huge plus for me, is people's palates have opened up. You know, I mean, I think sort of the event of cable television and the Food Network really sort of exposed people to ingredients and flavor combinations that you might not have been exposed to any other way. And for me, that's a blast because I like to play around with stuff. And before, I would just make things that I figured I would just be eating. And now those things that I think are sort of strange or out of the, you know, out of the context of a traditional candy store, unusual, I find now that there's, like, a good market for that. And that's sort of, like, where we've been able to create a little bit of a niche.
How much of your business is people walking in to just pick up some stuff that they want, and how much of it is mail order, or is any of it mail order? Do people say?
Oh yeah, we have we've had a website since 1999. So actually, we started that early on, even before people were sort of like, they weren't quite ready to trust the internet back then. But we had a website, so it's really hard to tell what the percentages are because the business itself is so spike oriented.
Sure.
You know, I mean, we just have these massive holidays. It's like we have a store in Salem, so October's crazy, and then Thanksgiving's crazy, and then Christmas is crazy, and then Valentine's Day is crazy, right?
Easter, yeah.
So it's really hard to sort of give a general percentage, but frankly, I think probably 80% or more are walk-ins, okay, and the rest of it's mail order. And the mail order is really, to me, the third shop. Like, another brick-and-mortar location doesn't really interest me, but we can grow with the website, and that's sort of all within under our same roof, which makes it a little bit better for the bottom line.
How has the changing of times and, you know, food issues, food allergies had an impact on the candy industry? So you have to, I'm guessing for labeling, you have to be extra careful about, you know, what's sugar-free versus no sugar added versus, you know, making sure people know that they have nuts in them versus
peanut
butter.
Whenever somebody comes in talking about a nut allergy, we just say, you know, everything we do is, we're called Turtle Alley, right?
Yeah.
So, and our actual production space is quite small. So if you've got an allergy, we're very sorry, but we really wouldn't recommend it just because it's, like, impossible to be sure, and we just wouldn't want anybody to get sick in any sort of way, you know?
So because you have such a small area, you can't guarantee that they didn't come in proximity to something.
Yeah, we couldn't.
A different batch.
No.
Yeah.
And it's better, as I said, better safe than sorry always, you know. One of the biggest changes has been the rise of celiacs, which is sort of, I mean, when you think about it, I think the first celiacs, like serious celiacs that I ever saw across the counter were about 10 years ago. And they helped me do a lot of the research because they were really not sure what they had, and they were trying things. And I think it was the most intense celiac we ever had, I think, was a woman named Elizabeth, who was super helpful to me. And she could eat all of our candies. So we are good and gluten-free. Unfortunately for my manager in the Salem shop, she's also a pretty intense celiac. So she eats everything and she's fine. So while we don't have necessarily a stamp that says that we are gluten-free, we have not experienced any issues, and neither have our celiac customers.
That's sort of the biggest one.
And what are some of the others that, that you have to deal with?
You know, lots of people want vegan chocolate, and we just don't do it.
What is
that? I don't know how to make candy without any sort of animal product. You know, there's butter and there's fat, and milk and stuff. So vegans, while it's not an allergy, it's often a choice. That's a sort of big one for us. We are unable to sort of help them in the candy world. And, of course, just health-wise, people are looking at sugar much more carefully.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think for me, as a business owner and as a chocolatier, I can only go so far. And, you know, I make candy, and it's got sugar in it. So I don't really – I carry sugar-free lines that people really like, but I myself, I don't really – I don't know how to make candy without sugar, so I sort of have to pick my battles.
Yeah. Okay. And what are some of the candies that are demand-oriented, unique to specific holidays? And by that I mean years ago you saw ribbon candy was more Christmas. You didn't see ribbon candy, you know, at Easter or what have you. And, you know, the little marshmallow chickies with the...
That's all still true.
Are Easter, but they have them now for... They fashion them for the Halloween.
Oh, for each holiday, yeah.
Yeah,
in fact, those, like those peeps that you're speaking of.
We
have gingerbread peeps that look like little gingerbread men, but it's still marshmallow. It's still that company. I think they're called Just Born. Yeah. So all that's still true. I will say that there's been a huge decrease in interest in ribbon candy, which sort of breaks my heart because it's, you know, a memory from my childhood, sure. But there's, like, very little demand for it. As far as what we make that's seasonally sort of big in the fall, I make caramel apples that are really, really, really popular. So that goes all through Halloween and through Thanksgiving. Right before almost every holiday, those caramel apples go. But insofar as what we make and what is big during the holidays, it's sort of different with each holiday. So Valentine's Day, truffles are a big seller. Christmas, milk cashew turtles are the biggest seller that we have, hands down, all year round. So literally, Christmas is about a milk cashew turtle. I mean, we have all the other stuff like candy cane bark, which is really huge during the Christmas season. I'm trying to think. Easter, of course, we have all sorts of and manners of bunnies and eggs.
Yeah.
So they're all, you know, it's pretty much the same as it has been with just little tweaks.
Okay. How long after you started your working at or owning one did you find that you ate less candy?
Oh, no, you eat it every day. You never get over it. Never get over it. I have been making chocolate for a total of 26 years, and I make it, I eat it every day. I did, long ago, I worked at an ice cream store, and I made ice cream for 6 years, and I have not touched an ice cream since. So I got over ice cream, but chocolate is different.
Never get it over.
I have to play a lot of tennis to make up for my sweet tooth.
I, as a child, I had 14 ice cream sandwiches when I was in middle school, and it was years before I could eat
before
an ice cream sandwich.
Before you touched it again, right?
And I always wondered, what about the person who works in the bakery?
I used to work in a bakery. I swear to God, I used to make fresh bread every morning. I was as big as a house when I was a bread baker.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm like not bread. Resist warm bread from the oven.
Virgilio's in Gloucester. I mean, I could just take those warm Italian rolls when they come out of the oven. But anyway,
I have a question.
Oh,
I got a quick question over here, sitting in the engineer seat.
Sure.
Do you have any specials for a guy who needs to get some stocking stuffers for his wife at the last minute and doesn't know what the hell to get? But I know it's got to be chocolates. If I come in there, can I get some help?
Yeah. You know what? We have really, really good people. And as far as the stocking stuffer goes, we have little cellophane bags that we can fill for you. So if you know sort of what your wife likes, then you can tell us what to put in that bag, and it'll fit in the stocking, and it'll be awesome.
You got this.
And if you don't know, then you can trust us to give you the stuff that sort of are the biggest sellers.
I love it. And you got Santa Clauses, and you got Christmas
we got it
ornaments.
All
right, I'm there.
Okay.
I'm there.
And we spend a lot of time helping people through that stuff, and that's what we do. That's our job. You're not hassling us. This is what we do.
All right.
Is there, when we grew up, there was a thing called penny candy, and I know that you could still see
candy
things that, you know, were penny candy, but...
I ate more paper than I ate candy, yeah, like it off there.
It doesn't cost a penny, but is any of that within your product line?
Oh, yeah, we have all that stuff. We don't make it, but we have it all.
Okay.
So,
all right.
And just to give you an idea, like, a strip of buttons is now a quarter. And a rock candy is 50 cents.
Okay.
So, you know,
what about an ice cube?
Penny candy anymore, but it is all the stuff that you remember from when you were a kid.
East Gloucester Fire Station, they had a candy closet and a Coke machine, and all the kids in the neighborhood came in to buy candy. And
oh, you're kidding me.
Oh, no.
I had no idea.
Yeah. The firemen ran a candy closet and,
East Gloucester up the hill on Mount Pleasant?
Yeah.
You know, there's all sorts of fancy cars in that fire
station. Yeah, well, the city sold it, and a guy that's a car collector bought it, but yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's really that, I have looked in those windows longingly since there were fancy cars in there.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and I'm sure Rick and I will be by to see you before Christmas to fill out our Christmas list.
Well, I'm really glad that we finally were able to connect.
Yeah.
And if you come in, make sure you ask for me so I can help you out.
Okay, great. Thank you,
Alec.
Have
a great holiday.
All right, you too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was interesting.
Yeah.
Have you been in there?
I haven't.
I've been in there many times.
That's
a great place.
Yeah, I've talked on the phone a few times. We keep missing each other, and we're going to have her in October, and October was tough because it was Halloween, and then, you know, I said, well, we'll get you in. We'll find a day, and this was the day.
Well, it's very busy over there, and it's a great, but very interesting. And the other thing, too, Joshua, I have to mention every time we have Julie LaFontaine on, what an amazing, I mean, we have these kinds of helps in all other communities, but we know Julie I know Julie better than the other people.
Yeah.
And what Open Door and Second Glance and all the helpers and all the staff do in this time, I mean, 1 in 6 people they feed, 1 in 6 on K-Ban. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Rockport, Gloucester, and I don't know about Essex, but It's just amazing what they do, and she is just absolutely tireless.
Oh, I know. She's a Rotarian. She's going to be the president of the club next year.
One more thing for her to do.
Yeah, but she'll do a good job.
All right, I think we're off for a while, if I'm not mistaken.
For 4 weeks,
okay.
And we're back on the 19th, and Diana DeZoglio, state representative, will be a guest on our show then, and I'm looking at some other people from the State House to be guests, and as we get into the 2018 election season, we'll be mixing some of those folks in along with our regular guests.
It's going to be an amazing election season. Witnessing what's happened in Virginia and Alabama, and especially, I've never watched television on a local senatorial race.
Yeah.
Until whatever it was, Tuesday, Thursday night, whatever it was, Wednesday night.
Yeah.
But this is going to be amazing. All right, Josh, Merry Christmas to you.
Merry
we'll
Christmas
see you after the new year.
Great.
It's Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Moore, producer and engineer, as always, Bill Proposky. Bye-bye.